This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. Good to hear your voice again.
All right. Well, it is Wednesday, the day after the election, and we're both in California, and there was a really interesting proposition on the measure, and that was to get rid of daylight savings time. And I thought it's going to be interesting whether or not that's going to happen. I think we all voted yes for it, but we've got to wait for the federal law. So as the season's changing, I guess we're going to daylight savings time. So I guess we've gained an hour of sleep, apparently, and all's good.
Yeah.
But that has nothing to do with the show today.
Okay, go ahead.
I was just bringing it up in of a roundabout way of some of the, myths and legends and urban things that I used to hear growing up about, if you lose an hour of sleep a day, now people are more likely to get in car accidents, and if we do away with that, then everyone does better. And so one of the things that we used to hear, a lot of urban legends, is that when little boys pick on little girls, we're told that it's because they like them. And this is one of the listener's questions. And so this listener wants to know if, Dr. Lyle, does that make sense? And is this why boys actually pick on girls? And is it analogous to bad boy behavior later on in life?
It's a really interesting question. And I think that we probably have to begin by looking at what kind of picking on girls that we would be observing. But if we're the kind that most of us are thinking, then this is probably what you're probably seeing is early flirtation instincts. And you're probably seeing some rehearsals that are going on that will be used later. A strategy for maintaining relationships where you are over-rewarded as a male is to attack the self-esteem or attack the confidence of the female. So you'll see this in what do you call it? Battering, abusive situations, etc. And you're going to undoubtedly see it in subclinical abusive situations as well, where a male who is anxious and disagreeable is going to essentially use little strategies to reduce the female confidence so that the female stays with him because it's the best deal she could get. This is a long ways from little boys, quote, picking on females, but it may have roots in a similar strategy. And, of course, some of it has nothing to do with it. Some of it is actually upside-down ways of flattering the girl and signaling interest. So I think that the answer is probably, this is sort of an open question as to all of the little instincts that are going on here. But clearly this is sort of deep instinctive behavior in human beings, or we wouldn't see this as a worldwide phenomenon that we can all quickly recognize. And that it's clearly that the boy is generally interested in the girl, wanting to get positive feedback and wanting to figure out how to engage that process. So this is, the most famous of all this stuff was, Tom Sawyer and Becky Thatcher. And, that's the sort of the iconic type of stuff that would go on there. But, yeah, in bad boy behavior, I don't know, bad boy behavior to me is sort of assertive, dominant behavior that would be out of males later. And that that probably young boys that would show that early at 7 or 8 years old are probably very much more testosteronized and more assertive and more disagreeable and far more likely to evidence those kinds of behaviors later in life, in flirtatious situations and everywhere else.
Fascinating. So what kinds of flirtatious situations are these young boys practicing? Is it the, you mentioned they're trying to pick up self-confidence,
practicing some dominance, practicing some socially risky behavior to potentially criticize someone. They're also looking potentially to set up contrast effects for if we insult someone on something and then we turn around and flatter them on something else, then we've set up a contrast effect for the flattery. So now the flattery is much more believable. Actually, it's interesting that the political scene here in the last couple, 3 days, I'm extremely uninterested in politics. But Trump is an interesting character to me. He's an interesting study, as he should be for anybody, any psychologist. And the Trump does interesting techniques that I believe come natural to him. And that is that he will insult people and then he'll turn around and flatter them. And these are contrast effects. The flattery means a great deal more after you've been insulted by the individual. It's like they've turned and now they see your inner beauty. So this is actually clearly what he did to Kim in North Korea. This is absolutely what this is about. And so it's a common thread that you'll see Trump do. And, you haven't seen that in politics. You haven't seen such sort of a car salesman, barroom-oriented strategy being used. But there it is. And so this sort of boys picking on girls is very much along these same lines. It's criticize first, flatter second. And by setting up contrast, it makes the flattery all the more potent.
So flatter first and criticize second definitely doesn't work, Dr. Lyle. That...
No, that's when you're leaving because you've been rejected. It's like, you weren't so great anyway, so the hell with you. That's how that works.
I saw a movie one time, and the gentleman – in high school was asking the girl, hey, would you like to go dance? And she very rudely said no. So he goes, oh, you must have misunderstood me. I said, you look fat in those pants. So yeah, it didn't quite work.
That's good. That's beautiful.
Perhaps he should have started with the first insult and then asked her to dance. But,
yeah, who knows? You got it.
Who knows? Okay.
All right.
Well, that certainly answers the question. I guess there's more about this in David Buss's Evolution of Desire. Talks mm-hmm. about right what women are looking for mm-hmm. and what men are looking for in evolutionary psychology of their dating thinking. But fascinating. Okay. Well, the next question is about dating as well, because so many people have questions about dating.
Yeah.
Dr. Lyle, I was wondering if you could talk about the psychology behind why people value certain gifts.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard Jerry Seinfeld observe that women are with men to get flowers. So if the gift of flowers is a key gesture in relationships with women, is evolutionary psychology the key to why women love to get flowers? It seems to be one of the most common gifts, along with fur coats and shiny objects. Are the neural circuits of our ancestors responsible for these gift preferences in modern humans?
Undoubtedly so. So this is really a beautiful question, and I should have insulted the question first and then said that. All right. This is a very good question, a very interesting one, and I don't know how much is known about these things, but we can see some very strong evolutionary roots in gift giving, and certainly gift giving of this kind. So a lot of what is romantic about gifts is the fact that they are wasteful. And so flowers are wasteful. They have no utility. And so there's a lot of little shiny stuff and jewels and so on and so forth. So the and it's noticed that jewels or jewelry is not only is it wasteful, it's very wasteful because the materials are difficult to get. And if the materials aren't difficult to get, then some very complicated, high energy, high skill, a great deal of time and energy has gone into weaving the thing together or putting little scratches in it that look perfect, and it tells the story of Ruth, you know, on your bracelet or whatever it is. In other words, what you're looking at is the ability to waste energy. So what gifts are, romantic gifts, are actually largely what these are, is they are fitness indicators. The they have a, if you're a sports watcher, which I am, you know, sorry. The one of the pitchmen of the world, one of the better pitchmen in the world, is Peyton Manning. He's got such a boy next door face and demeanor. He's just kind of priceless. He's got honest stamped on across his forehead. He's every mother-in-law's dream. And Peyton is now become the pitch man for, I can't remember, I think Nationwide Insurance Company. And so now I think Kenny Chesney, or there's some country star that is his sidekick now. And so Peyton, there's an ad where he and Kenny, I think, get off the bus, and they're looking over at these women huddled around a table, and it's a baby shower, and the girl's opening, the young lady's opening her gifts, and Peyton says, "Now, it should be an insurance policy. It's the perfect gift." You know, and of course Chesney, I think that's who it is. I don't know who it is. Just a country star name that comes to my head. But the he's like rolling his eyes at this big oafish football player that just obviously doesn't get it. But Peyton is known to be intelligent and fastidious. And so here he is just thinking, and then he sees the little booties come out. And he's like, well, that's not good for anything. Like, what good is that? they've done a really good job here of painting him as this, you know, this sort of straight-laced utilitarian male that just doesn't get the romantic. He's just not in him. And this is what romantic is. And so to the best of my knowledge, Jeffrey Miller is the first person to actually grasp this really at its root. And that is that romantic means wasteful. And so the more wasteful a gift is, the more romantic it is. So flowers are wasteful. So what did the guy do? He went all over the valley and he picked out all these flowers. And so why is this impressive? Because he was able to get enough food for himself and take care of all of his other business and had the time and energy in excess that he could actually waste it on doing this, just so that you could look at them and for a few brief moments have your nervous system tickled with the different colors, which are pleasant because they're a reliable sign of ripening fruit in an environment. So it's not the actual food which would have been practical. It's actually, you know, that would have been Peyton's insurance policy. It's in fact wasteful. And so the same thing is going to be true of a party. You know, it's not a romantic party unless there's flowers and little gifts and, you know, fancy napkins and a band. And in other words, wasteful. And a wedding dress, wasteful. Why not just get married in something that you got at Macy's, looks good, guy said, thinks you look great. It's like, no, we're going to spend $2,500. Wasteful. Okay? So these are what these things are more often than not, is what gifts are fitness indicators. And so that's why precious metals are a good thing, because they're hard to get. It's hard to get them. And so they happen to also flowers wouldn't work if they didn't tickle the nervous system of Stone Age ancestors. And the same thing is going to be true of precious metals and jewelry, that precious metals, you know, tickle the neural circuits of people. And so girls like shiny things with pretty colors, and that are also known to be of materials that are difficult to get, okay, and hopefully put together by a craftsman that took a great deal of time and energy putting it together. Wasteful. So that's the fundamental story of romantic gifts, is that it is a fitness indicator of the giver. And it's also a signal that they were using their excessive fitness and they're laying it at your feet, and they're basically saying, I have excessive energy to give, and I'm going to give it to you. This is not a trade. In other words, I'm not looking to give you, you know, a bunch of apples that I picked for a bunch of oranges. No, I can just waste this energy, and I'm going to waste it on you. That is a major signal indicating that the male will continue to get more practical things once this phase is over and he starts to get into your pants or skirt. Then we're going to start talking about that he's the excessive abilities that he has over and above his own survival are clearly now going to be directed towards her children. Okay, so that's what this is, and I'm sure that's the evolutionary history of romantic gifts.
So, Dr. Lai, can you give us an example of a romantic gift that you've given?
Well, how about a washer dryer? How does that go? We better skip over this. That's not a history that went too well.
I guess we're on the same page. Right. A romantic gift I gave was a clothes dryer, like the, you know, you can hang
yeah.
clothes while you're steaming them.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Boy, we got some things in common here. All right.
And so, are males compelled to waste when they find the woman that, you know, like that? That's what I've always been curious about, because I've met males and females on both sides. Some of them are just mm-hmm. naturally not so concerned with a little bit excess, and some who are just incredibly stereotypically cheap and don't like to waste at all. And so, the question I have is: are males compelled, where they suddenly, you know, they don't really feel that same level of cheapness when they find the mate? That say pair bond, and now they're like, no, yeah, I'll spend the money, no big deal.
Oh, you mean? I'm sure. I have a belief that essentially these are, if I'm not mistaken, what you're going to be seeing here is these are universal instincts that are, in other words, so these are neural circuits that reside in all normal members of the species, and so, however, there's going to be not only individual genetic variation, but there's going to be contextual strategy. So a guy might be very cheap, but suddenly he meets somebody who he feels like is a potential of an offer he can't refuse. And suddenly he feels for the first time in his life, quote, very romantic. And he just feels like doing, quote, romantic things, which are very wasteful. So the instinct gets activated. Okay. As soon as he seals the deal, he's back to being Peyton Manning. Okay. And so I think that's whereas other people by nature probably simply have that instinct run a great deal hotter, and they may be in generally just a far more romantic soul that is willing to do wasteful things. Go out into the middle of the night under, you know, a rainstorm and be soaking wet just to, I don't know, rescue the little frog that his girlfriend hears chirping, you know, in the little backyard pool, whatever. In other words, just whatever thing that doesn't bother this guy. It's in his soul to do this. And it's just, he's got, you know, what can I say? He's a Frenchman. You know, this is how he's built. And undoubtedly, you know, around the globe, there has been individual regional selection, sexual selection on this characteristic. And so this is probably, I wouldn't doubt that in future generations of behavior genetics research, that we're going to find that instincts like this probably vary regionally, and so we're probably going to be able to be better than average at predicting what an individual is like on this dimension by virtue of where their ancestors came from, 100 years ago.
Okay, interesting.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I got the more practical chip. I just,
I have received.
All right. Oh, right. I have another one. Hold on a second.
Yeah. Yeah. Like
Christmas. I new tires, but they were very good new tires, and they were new tires for a four-wheel drive. And she really wanted like white letters, the fancy like off-road stuff. So they were considerably more expensive, and I choked it down. So there you go. That was a very expensive Christmas. But hey, it got a big smile. Yeah, there you go.
I like it. So what's the least romantic gift you've given?
I don't.
Just kidding.
We'll pass over that. I don't want to think about it.
Yeah.
All right, on we go.
All right, so now speaking, as we go from extreme like of a person, now our next question is about, Dr. Lyle, how do I beat my genes to get over an extreme dislike for a coworker? I'm highly agreeable and easygoing and usually can get along with almost anyone. That being said, I currently work with someone who I dislike so much that it makes me just want to quit work so I never have to see them again. What's worse is that I'm technically his boss, but I don't have enough authority to reprimand him. How do I approach the situation without brooding over my extreme dislike of this person? And what's going on psychologically that's triggering this extreme volatility?
Well, that's a great question. And all I can do is guess, and without a call in and sort of going down through nitpicking our way through the little subtle details, I may not be able to come up with anything, but I'll try. The fundamental root is an esteem dynamic between our person and the person on the other side. So an extreme dislike is being driven by by a manner of this relationship where probably extreme dislike is usually a derivative of feeling angry. And we're usually feeling angry because we feel like we're being treated unfairly. So there's something in the esteem dynamic between these two individuals where our individual believes that the other person is treating them unfairly, and I'm not sure how. Okay? Now, it's possible that the reason why the other person's treating them unfairly is because they themselves feel like they've been mistreated, or they are being unfairly judged in some way, i.e. unfairly treated. So what we may have is a vicious cycle of esteem dynamics. Now, what we can try to do is we can actually grit our teeth and attempt to reverse the vicious cycle and spin it into a virtuous cycle. And the way we would do that would be to be very careful and crafty about starting to publicly praise this individual and give them positive feedback when it's appropriate. Okay, so this is so I know that the person listening is saying, no, I think I'm going to take a hit on my bong first, and I'm not really interested in listening to this, but hear me out. What we're attempting to do, we have essentially think of a whirlpool in the ocean, and it's going clockwise, and we're going to try to actually reverse it and to make it go counterclockwise. And so we need to do something extreme with this esteem dynamic. In other words, we don't know where it started and how, but somebody felt mistreated and they retaliated with some kind of animal signaling to the other person back saying, you're an unfair SOB. And then the other person said, what do you mean I'm an unfair SOB? You're an unfair SOB. And then around the circle it goes. So what we need to do is we need to see if there's any root to this where we can slam the brake on and then put force and start to spin it the other direction. Okay? Now, if we do this, in other words, we think about over the next, 6 weeks, where our job in life is to think about, be looking for moments when that individual deserves any kind of praise and give it to them. So it's not going to be like 5 times a day, because then suddenly this is this weird situation where clearly, there's been an artificial process. We don't want them thinking it's an artificial process. We want them thinking that it's an organic process. And so we're going to plan and think about and then figure out, it's better even if it's public, if other people are watching. If other people are not watching, that's fine too. As long as it's authentic and it's not patronizing, we attempt to give the person positive feedback. Okay. Now, and then we're going to do it more than once. And we're going to try to essentially give little blasts in the whirlpool, blasts trying to blast it the other direction and try to see if we can spin this thing in the other direction. Now, we may not be able to do so, okay? So if we cannot do this, then the next thing that we're going to try to do is I would actually go to your supervisor and say, listen, this is the situation. This is just a cancerous relationship. It's just not getting any better. And I actually have made serious attempts to try to improve it, and I've tried to do what I could, and it's not improving, and it's just no good. So I don't know what the person's workplace structure is and what the options are, but if we put it in our supervisor's head that we would like to have this person moved out from underneath us in the power structure and essentially away from us in the work structure. There may not be a time to do it now, but there may be, depending upon the company, there may be a way to get that done. And our supervisor may say, be patient. I know that I understand the issue. I may be able to help you on this at some point a little later on down the road, but for now, you got to choke it down. Okay? Not bad. We've now started the wheels in motion. And so we're going to try to do it that way. I have a method for helping people try to get through periods that are problematic. And it's what I call the mathematization of misery. So it's useful to know that your miseries are limited. So there's only, you may, for example, put it on the clock how many minutes a day you actually have to interact with this individual. And it may turn out that it's 17 minutes a day on average. At which point you know that when you're interacting with them, every minute you're like, hey, 1 minute less, 1 minute less, and if you, et cetera. So you essentially get so you realize your day is not actually overwhelmed by the individual. It's 17 minutes a day, which is not that big a deal. And all we have to do is grit our teeth for those 17 minutes, go eat a few Cheetos as a reward at the end of it, and forget it. Okay? That's the mathematization of misery. You can do that kind of on a daily basis, and you can also have it in your mind's eye that there's a plot behind that person's back between you and your supervisor to get you out from under this process, this situation, which is not good, and that it may take us a year to do it or 6 months, at which point you can be thinking, okay, I've got 17 minutes a day times 5 days a week, so I've got 85 minutes. I've got 85 minutes times, maybe 48 weeks. So, whatever this thing is, I've got, 64 hours. But, that's it. Then it's done. Okay, so then it's almost a joy that when you interact with the guy for 5 minutes, it's like, now it's 64 hours minus 5 minutes, Chief. And you go check it off on a grid in your office. So this feeling that our suffering is not indefinite. It's actually limited. And we start to actually enjoy the process of having survived a round of it, because we get to go check it off in our office that we're not going to have to do it again after this. Okay? So these are some mental operations that you can use to try to, you know, essentially get yourself in a what seemingly a position of power over the situation. Now, finally, obviously, yeah, let's suppose that there are intractable things. We can't change the esteem dynamic between us and the other individual. It turns out that we get no help from the people above. There's no possible way that this thing is ever going to change, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? Well, then we have to start thinking about, really, is this the only job in the world where anybody is ever going to pay me this amount of money for this kind of work? Because if it is, I'm insecure as hell anyway. Okay? So now we have to start to arrive at the concept of a position of power. A position of power is, are we in a, you know, whatever it is that we want, can we live without it? The what we want is this job without this guy there. Can we live without it? And the answer is undoubtedly yes. If this individual, you know, has a computer and could write us an email, they're not starving and they're not in a halfway house, you know what I'm saying, with food stamps. So the idea is, and they're theoretically somebody's supervisor, who is apparently stable enough to hold a job for more than 6 weeks. So that tells us that the person that wrote into this, wrote into us, has some brains and has some stability, which means they've got options, and you are not mousetrapped into this mess forever. It's a choice to be there. So the final straw is, if we cannot get support, if we can't change the dynamic, and we cannot get any semblance of support, and there's no way to work our way out from under this situation from within our organization, then we are on the job market looking for an equivalent or better job. And now it's like, hey, no problem, I can put up with this jerk, because the truth is, sometime in the next year, I'm going to get a job offer, and then I'm going to be gone. Okay? So we're in a position of power of knowing that no matter how you look at it, the misery is going to be mathematized, because you are not a prisoner there. You're not a tree. Okay? You're not a victim of circumstances. You have the ability to change your circumstances, and all we have to do is put up with some hassle. So those are some ideas about how to mentally approach this kind of a mess.
All right. Fascinating. Well, that leads beautifully into our next question, where the person is actually in a captive. He's a college sophomore. Dr. Lyle, how don't you lose your mind when ignorant people all around you are broadcasting their false beliefs? I'm 18 years old, college sophomore on the pre-med track, and it's extremely irritating when I hear my professors tell me that a Whole Foods plant-based diet is wrong and that so many of the health issues we face today have no relationship to the foods we eat. Years and years and years, I'm left hearing this, and I might explode. When I'm asked why I eat the way I do, I say because of research studies I read on PubMed, which seems to be the only response I can give that gets a bit of respect. The professors act like they know far more in this area of study than I do and assume that I'm just a typical, uneducated student, which is far from the truth.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Okay. So there's a number of issues here. And so we'll just take a few of them and see where this goes. The first thing that we're going to see here is that this young man, I assume it's a young man because he's pretty argumentative, so therefore there's a good chance that that's true, but it might not be true. We've got some hell raising young women who are going to educate the world about health too. So let's suppose that this young person is now operating as a normal human, and the normal human says, when I find superior information, I want to bring it to the village. And not only do I want to bring it to the village, I want credit. Okay? I want credit. This is the esteem process at work. So the safest person in the village, the person who has the safest genes, is the one that is considered the most valuable. So your value is a multiply determined index having to do with how good looking you are and how smart you are and how athletic you are and how well you sing and dance and do other things and how pleasant you are and how tough you are and how fair you are and everything else under the sun. But one of the things that's involved is how good are you at ferreting out new information that's really useful for the village. So smart people specifically aren't trying to impress people with their crochet, okay, or their beach muscles. Smart people's stock and trade is I can bring new information to the village, and I want my appropriate amount of steam coming back from you. So this person at 18 years old already knows more than, you know, 98% of the physicians in the world. This is true. And and the professors are not that knowledgeable, surprisingly, and for various and sundry reasons why this is the case. And so, however, it's also true that there's a reason why there's actually widespread a degree of ignorance in this arena, and that's because it's more subtle than people know. The truth is actually more subtle than people are aware of. And that is that, you know, super healthy living diet-wise is only going to add a very few years of lifespan to the average individual. It's not to hear it told by, you know, plant-based or healthy-based eating physicians, it's as if it's a huge issue. It is a huge issue on an individual level for a very sick person. It might be the difference between dying of a heart attack at 64 and living to 94. So the, you know, on an individual issue, it could be huge. But very few normal human beings would ever die at 64, and not with unusual levels of pathology and unusual levels of behavior that was really seriously counterproductive to their health that anyone would recognize. So typical people are going to live to mid-70s to mid-80s. And at that level, the difference between an average actor with average health behaviors and a superior actor with superior health behavior, the difference in life expectancy is very small. It's about 3 to 4 years. And so therefore, when people are trying to parse their way through the various variables that may be responsible for these differences, it's not going to be at all clear what is true and what isn't true. So, and that's why the professors wind up, unless they actually grasp the overall argument and are aware of particularly impressive, comprehensive studies, they're not going to know. And so they're going to be lost in the weeds that are pretty tall, looking for effect sizes that they're not going to be able to see. And so some whippersnapper who comes in there and says, hey, you're missing the boat, they know they're not missing any major boat, which they're really not. And they are pretty accurate. And so when we try to jump up and down and make a big fuss about this and try to get a bunch of esteem for it, they're in no way interested, and they know they're on pretty solid ground, and they're not going to listen, and they're not motivated to listen. So we're signaling to them that they are not deserving of the status that they have, according to the hierarchy, they've rightfully earned. And then our young whippersnapper is all bent out of shape because they know they're right, which incidentally they are. They just may not be accurate in terms of magnitude. But since they know that they've got some important information, they're trying to bring it to the village and get credit, and they're not getting any credit at all. So this is going to be very frustrating. Now, so the important thing here is to understand that what you're after is you're after esteem. And you're after esteem from these people, and you're thinking that you should deserve it. They have a content area interest that is the same as yours in principle. And so as a result, when you're bringing new information, it's like you've got a bunch of people that are interested in bows and arrows, and then you bring a better version, and they're basically saying not interested. And so it's extremely frustrating. And so I understand this. So instead, what we need to do is to look at this problem just a little bit differently. So this young person is apparently pre-med, and so they very well may wind up becoming a doctor. Maybe so. Be fine if it's true. If you want to do this and jump through all those hoops and do this for a living, that's a perfectly fine thing to do with your life. Now, however, I remember having an incident sometime in the last 25 years when I was in a legal proceeding, and I was concerned that the other side wasn't going to be telling the truth, and that, you know, this was going to make me look bad. And so I talked to my sister, who's a Cracker Jack attorney, and I explained the situation to her, and she said, "That's just beautiful. Nothing could be better." So my sister was always happy when the other side would lie and cheat and do all kinds of other things, because it would set up a pattern to when the finding of fact would eventually get done, we would be able to display the entire thing in context, and everything was going to be fine. Now, obviously, you know, innocent people have gotten in trouble in court and people have lost in court. But from the standpoint of my sister's perspective, my sister was very patient with essentially the other team not playing fairly, and just felt like, no, this is fine. This is going to play into your hands quite well. And I would say that the same thing is true here. You're 18 years old. As you watch these people up there, you're watching people who are not curious enough and not intellectually courageous enough to actually grasp the fact that there's been major innovations in thinking and that there's better information. And so they're just going to keep telling the same old story, and you are an innovator. And it means that most of your students on the left and the right, they're going to become medical doctors, are not going to have the intellectual courage or the interest to follow the truth the way your nose is telling you to follow it. And as a result, you'll meet them all again on their way to the middle. And there they'll be cutting out gallbladders and making their good money and doing whatever it is that they're doing. But you have the opportunity to do something very special, which is to actually coach sick people into being well. Now, we don't wish that to be the only person that can do it. But if nobody else is going to do it, guess what? The door's wide open for you. So what you're seeing actually is not bad news at all. It's short-term frustrating because you're not getting the status at 18 years old that you wish that you had. But you know what? It wouldn't be reasonable for you to get that status now. But be patient. Okay, so the mediocre intellectual curiosity and application will lead to lives of you know, people in this, your competitors in the industry, will be remain mediocre. And if you do not remain mediocre, you're going to be special. So the specialness that you're evidencing now will be more valuable later because of the resistance that you're observing now. And that's how that is. This is it's frustrating. I was as a young psychologist, I could not stop talking about evolutionary psychology. So any young psychologist or any psychologist that I ran into, I was immediately starting to download them, laying some truth on them. And what I got back was disinterest and some degree of, what do you call it? Yeah, even worse than disinterest, a little bit of eyeball rolling and really nobody cares. And, of course, I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. What are you, a bunch of idiots? Apparently so. Okay, they weren't stupid. They had no intellectual courage and no curiosity. They might have had plenty of IQ, but without curiosity and intellectual courage, you know what? You meet them all again on their way to the middle, and that's what they are, okay? So today, none of those people has people listening to me. Like here I have with this goofy little radio show, but we got 5,000, 6,000 people listening. It's no great accomplishment, but the people that are listening are not normal. They're bright, intellectually curious, intelligent people, and they're paying attention and they're trying to learn. Okay? I don't know of another psychologist that has five people, including their own parents or mother-in-law or anybody else, that's willing to listen to them. Okay? But I do. And it's very gratifying to have walked a road that was uncomfortable. Okay? Uncomfortable. You know, plenty of negative feedback. Plenty of people rolling their eyes. Plenty of people covering their ears and saying, no, you know, that's sexist, that's racist, that's nationalistic, that's this, that's that, that's cultural this. Like, oh, you're a free enterprise, this is how people ought to live, yeah? No, I don't think so. You know, how dare you? Okay, there's no end to it. So, yeah, intellectual courage. When you discover the laziness, mediocrity, and generally self-inflicted incompetence of people that don't have the chops to actually follow a road that's a little bit uncomfortable, just relax. Just like my sister would say, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Okay, it'll play out just fine in the end. Okay, so be patient.
Fascinating. Dr. Lott, I think we'll end there. We'll take the next questions next week. Really appreciate your perspective. It's incredible.
Vented my spleen. I got it in there. All right. Very good, Nate. See you next week.
Thanks for listening. All right. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.